Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We hope you're all having a happy holiday week, hopefully enjoying some time off, and a very Merry Christmas if you celebrated. This week on All of It, we're bringing you a series of theme shows we're calling the All of It Guide to Your Holiday Week. Today, a show full of authors of fiction. For a very long time, a young man named Nane Kwame Adejibrenya worked a pretty typical job for a young person in retail at the Palisades Mall in West Nyack. You know, the one with the big Ferris wheel. Well, while he was there, he worked one of the most brutal shifts in the industry, Black Friday. And the fact that an event like Black Friday could be so absurd, so dangerous, and yet so socially acceptable and, quote, normal, stayed with him. It's the subject of the title story in his first short story collection, Friday Black. The book has been very well received. A review in the New York Times reads, Friday Black is an unbelievable debut, one that announces a new and necessary American voice. We spoke to Nana back in November, and we are replaying that interview for you now. Welcome to the studio. That's quite a, Nana, that's quite a review to get.
I know. Every time I hear it, I kind of stand up a little straighter. I've since met Tommy Orange, and I told him I probably need to name my firstborn Tommy after that review.
So I've seen all these descriptions of describing the genre of your book. Horror, satire, dark comedy. What do you call it?
Thanks for that question. It's not something I get often, actually. I think I've sort of actively resist the genre stuff, but any particular distinction, because I think pretty much part of the power of the book is that it, from story to story, does a lot of different things. One author actually did ask me this, and this is a genre per se, but I think of them as dark little hope machines, maybe. I think of them as small imagination expanders.
That's interesting that using little and small, because one of my questions I have written down is for later, but I'm going to ask it now, is why do you think short stories are good for talking about difficult things like ending pregnancies? That's in your book, Stand Your Ground, Death by Consumer Consumption.
I think for me anyways, one of the things that is powerful about the short form and engaging these issues is we kind of are made to think about these issues by these sort of short little narratives that pop up again and again in the news, you know, so they sort of how we conceive of these problems. So for me, I was in college when Trayvon Martin was murdered. That's one particular specific story, and it sort of was a way into this much larger sort of systematic racism that we have in this country. So I think short stories are kind of a way to give you the tip of the iceberg, which that is, and so it's a digestible, small sort of narrative that gives you sort of maybe a feeling of like this huge, massive thing that is sort of behind it.
So you've got all this intensity in this little package.
Yeah.
Sort of concentrated, and then you can sort of figure it out afterwards.
And yes, and it's a little bit more easy to conceive of a very specific, you know, issue. And that's told well told and pretty quickly told, I guess, and then work your way towards the sort of more critical theory aspects that might maybe inform ways we can actually fix these sort of broken systems.
I want to ask you to read from one of your stories, Zimmerland.
Yeah.
Which of course reminds you of George Zimmerman.
Yeah.
Explain to people what it's about before I write where the asterisk is.
So it's basically takes place in a world where there is something called justice parks. And in these justice parks, you can sort of play through high stakes justice, quote unquote, justice scenarios. And what actually happens is bigoted people end up coming there to pretend murder the protagonist, who is black, over and over again.
Mm-hmm. So why don't you take a look where the asterisk is, read a little bit.
I locate myself in Cassidy Lane's primary player. A young man who's up to no good or nothing at all. I tuck the trigger joint behind my ear as the buzzer goes off. I watch the screen. The patron looks like he's in his 40s. He's kind of fat with reddish hair and wearing jeans and a t-shirt. He sits on a couch. He has on an orange bracelet on his wrist, which means he signed the waiver for full contact. Green means I can't touch them. Orange means I can engage the patron with reasonable and moderate physical contact to enhance the module's visceral engagement. Green or orange, I don't know which patrons are worse. The induction process begins in House 336. A voice like warm gravy comes to the speaker, shaped like books on a bookcase. Welcome to Cassidy Lane, your home, your safe place. The voice recaps how the patron has performed to that point, explaining everything in a tight little narrative that covers whether or not they succeeded in identifying who was stealing money at the work trick module, how amazing it was that they stopped the terrorist plot at the terror train module if they chose to pay an additional $35, and how now, finally, they can go relax, safe at home.
You're listening to Nane Kwame Adjei-Brenya reading from his new book, Friday Black. It's a collection of short stories. That one was called Zimmerland. When you're in your writing process, do you have a subject that you want to tackle, an issue you want to tackle, and then write your story, or does it all just come in a wave?
I actually don't ever think, you know, this will be a capitalism story. This will be a racism story. I kind of really think about sort of, you usually get a character's voice actually first, or a character in a particular situation, and then the story sort of grows from that place.
So voice then situation.
Voice or situation. Sometimes, I mean, sometimes, you know, in my initial like sort of conceiving, I'll have enough that I'd be like, okay, this is going to end up being about this thing. Because, you know, if very early on I think of something like the blackness scale in the first story, mm-hmm. you know, I kind of know that this is going to deal with race. But I don't ever think, let me like write the race story now.
Right, and you're referring to in the blackness scale in the first story, your characters sort of modulate their language and their code switching.
Yeah.
Throughout the story, he says, "Well, I'm at a 5.0 blackness right now, or I'm a 10 blackness," and it's funny, but it's also really sad.
Yeah, funny. That's like pretty much the whole my whole thing. That's like my lane. funny but sad. Yeah.
Now, I want to talk about the title. I know we've talked about it a lot, but it's so interesting to me that you worked retail on Black Friday. And what you saw. So was it always in your mind, obviously you've been a storyteller for a long time, this is going to be a story someday?
You know, I think before I'd fully like allowed myself to think that I could or was had the capacity or that anyone actually in real life could become a writer, I was just sort of affected by what I was seeing. And later on, I think I learned to look for those moments that I am affected as sort of my source. And so, yeah, I, you know, after my first Black Friday, just the chaos of it, it's like, I can't forget about it. You know, I can't not write about it, I think, because it's just so wild. And it's also like, and sometimes for me, it's like, I need to get something out of this because it took so much out of me. So I'm going to get something out of it.
As it's interesting, the characters in the story kind of become like monosyllabic creatures in their quest for stuff. Why did you make them so animalistic, the buyers?
Yeah, so often I think I'll use something like hyperbole to like make a point. And so in Friday Black, they've all been infected by the Friday Black. You know, that's like on Black Friday, certain people are just taken completely. They become monsters, zombies, and you know, people are dying left and right. And for me, again, that slight exaggeration that I hope causes initial sort of resistance in the reader's mind, I think is potentially very powerful, because in real life, people have and do kill each other for sneakers. People have trampled other human beings to death to get to a television screen. That's real life. And so for me, what's the difference if they aren't foaming at the mouth in full zombie mode or full whatever they are, whatever in Best Buy let them kill another human being to like trample them to death. Mm-hmm.
So you just take it to the end of it. As far as your imagination can take it. Like they're sweeping up kids' bodies who are getting trampled like it's nothing.
You know, sometimes I just sometimes I feel like I'm understating it actually, you know. I mean, I push it in terms of like what I push is the way through which we are okay with it. You know, I make it so okay. But because, you know, when that happens, it's reported as a tragedy, you know, but nothing seems to actually happen regarding the fact that it happened. And actually, Black Friday, while I was working, you know, it got earlier and earlier. You know, eventually I was coming to the mall at 10 o'clock on Thanksgiving Day from when it used to be coming at 8 8 a.m. on Friday. So, you know, it's kind of my thing is like, well, let's just like, let's make the response match the actions. And then you kind of have this sort of something like surreal sort of situation. I think it's super important in these kind of stories, especially stories that employ so much violence, so much like harshness, to self-implicate, to implicate yourself. Mm-hmm. I'm not like on some hill trying to teach everybody how to be a better person. I'm in these systems just the same as everybody. I've felt my personal self-worth was diminished because I didn't have whatever Jordans or whatever it might have been. And I really did actually win a jacket from my mom because I really did want to show her this thing, you know, that I care and I want you to have this. If you have this now, everyone can know what I don't know what they want you to know. And I think those systems are really good at sort of pulling something out of you and selling it back to you, whether it's love or whatever, whatever else, you know, this thing that is internal, this thing that you have, this thing that only you could actually really show. And it's like, you know what? I'll let you have it. I'll show it back. But so again, for me, that self-implication is really important. That main character, you know, he's not outside of this thing. He's participating just the same, even though he's a little bit, he feels like maybe he's on the other side.
So you hope people get a realization, maybe they see themselves and their faults in this book, perhaps?
I hope that we all do, yeah. You know, or at least I know for sure I want to make it seem that I am full of faults just as anybody else is.
Nane Kwame Adeje Brenya, the name of the book is Friday Black. It's a series of short stories. It's really interesting. Congratulations on your book.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to all of it on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We'll see you on the other side of the break. This is all of it on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Welcome back. A few years ago, Angie Thomas was working as a church secretary in Jackson, Mississippi, and finishing the manuscript for a young adult novel about a black teenager named Star who finds her voice as an activist after witnessing the deadly shooting of her childhood friend by a white police officer. Her book, The Hate U Give, got rave reviews for its deft handling of complex themes and characters, including Star's uncle, a black cop trying to do the right thing. The novel has spent 93 weeks on the New York Times Young Adult bestseller list, and it's still there as of this recording. This past fall, the movie adaptation of the book was released. I spoke to Angie Thomas back in October, the day before the film came out, and we are replaying the interview for you now. Angie, welcome to All of It. So much has happened to you in 2 years, even since we got together a year ago and did a story for PBS. What has been the most surreal moment in the past 2 or 3 years for you?
You know, it feels cliche to say meeting Obama. It was very brief, but that was surreal.
Oh, no doubt.
Yeah, so that's definitely like one of the top moments. But I think it's hard for me to say that there's one surreal moment. You know, even seeing the movie being filmed is surreal. But I think for me, it's every single time that I have a young black girl specifically who comes up to me and she's like, oh my God, this is me. Thank you so much for this book. Like, this is the first book I've read from beginning to end. That's like every time I get that, it's the best feeling. So I think that even tops meeting Obama.
Well, I think we all know intellectually representation matters, mm-hmm. but emotionally, when you experience with somebody, it's a whole other level.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, because I'm in the industry I'm in, I'm hearing that all the time. You know, we need more diverse books, blah, blah, blah. And I know that, but when you see it, it's an entirely different thing. When you see the reaction and the emotion that a young girl has when she says, like, this is me, thank you for this book, and she's hugging it tight, like, that lets me know, yes, she needed that, so I have to keep going.
When you first started working on this project, I know you're a student of history, and there are two very important stories, one in recent history and one from, you know, 60, 70 years ago, Emmett Till's story, mm-hmm. as well as the story of Oscar Grant. So share with our audience why these two stories were so important for you to research and know more about as you began to write this book.
It was extremely important to research both of them. Emmett Till specifically because as a young black girl growing up in Mississippi, I grew up hearing about Emmett Till. You know, I go to school visits now and I ask kids, you know, how many of you know the name Emmett Till? and very few of them will raise their hands outside of Mississippi. So I grew up hearing that story and hearing that warning, so to speak, of this young black boy who was accused of basically stepping out of line, and it caused him to lose his life. And I remember learning that Rosa Parks once said that one of the reasons she didn't give up her seat that day was because she thought of Emmett. And I read his mom's autobiography before I started writing The Hate U Give, because this was a woman who took a stand. You know, when she decided that she wanted his picture, the picture of his brutally beaten body, publicized in newspapers and magazines around the world, she was saying, we're not going to hide this anymore. This has been happening. We're not going to hide it. We want the entire world to see what's happening here in Mississippi. And her doing that changed the world as we know it. So I had to look to her and her bravery as I was crafting Star and thinking about Star and what it means to speak up and speak out in the face of such danger. So I always look to history as I craft my characters, because I need to know who's been through these things so that I can know where my characters are going. When it came to Oscar Grant, Oscar stood out for me because in some ways Oscar is considered the first modern Black Lives Matter case, because this was like one of the first times it was caught on tape. And so many people don't know his name. So many people aren't familiar with his story. There was a movie done about the last day of
Fruitvale
his life.
Fruitvale Station, right?
Right, right. But so many people are unaware. And for me, when Oscar happened, that was like my awakening moment as a young person. I was in college, and I saw the video. And
this happened in the Bay Area.
Yes.
Just for people, on BART, the transportation. He was involved in the scuffle.
Well, he wasn't. There
he
was
wasn't,
like they
right.
were on the train, and they were. It was like New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, and they were loud and partying on the train. And the train ended up getting stopped, and police officers pulled them off because they were saying they were loud and rowdy when everybody on the train was loud and rowdy. And Oscar was lying flat on his stomach on the ground. And I think they said the officer thought he was going for his stun gun, but he pulled out his gun and he shot him in the back. And he wasn't charged with anything. And it led to a lot of unrest in Oakland. And it led to conversations for me in my hometown in Jackson, Mississippi. So Oscar was one of those times where I felt my rage activated. Like, I've heard stories about things like this, of police brutality. I have family members who've experienced things, but here it was solid proof that it wasn't just me and my family experiencing this, or it wasn't just us in Mississippi. And I think we have to look at that and that ripple effect Oscar Grant had on so many of the current cases we see.
The project, The Hate U Give, started as a project, as a college, in your college writing course. And your professor, who I've spoken to, he saw something in this story and in you. So what did he tell you, help you with, that let the story evolve from a senior project to something that could be bigger?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing he did before I even wrote it, he gave me great advice, because I was telling him one day, I was like, you know, You tell us all the time, write what we know, but I'm not sure that people care about what I know. I'm not sure people care about what happens in neighborhoods like mine and stuff like that. And he said, there are stories in your community that deserve to be told. Why aren't you the person to tell them? And that stuck with me, and it stayed with me, and it influenced me, and that's what pushed me to write it. And so when I decided to turn it into a novel, I kept that in mind. You know, I'm seeing this happen. I'm hearing conversations on a wider scale. This was after Trayvon Martin had happened, and Michael Brown and Tamir Rice. And I'm hearing all of these conversations, and I'm hearing all of these politicians try to justify why it's okay a 12-year-old boy lost his life. And I kept thinking about what my professor said. Why can't you be the one to tell this story? There are stories in your community that need to be told. Why shouldn't you tell them? And so I think as an artist, as a writer, I won't say it's necessarily my responsibility to do that all the time, because I feel as if the artist's responsibility is first to themselves. So my responsibility is not to my community necessarily. But Terry McMillan once said something that stayed with me, and she said, writers of fiction write lies in order to help others see truth. And that's what I wanted to do. So it was remembering that he said, just tell the stories. If you feel like you should tell it, tell it. That's what pushed me to write the book.
Even though it is a piece of fiction, you did a lot of research. You read autopsy reports, you read police reports. What were you looking for in that research, and where can we see it in the book?
When I was doing my research, I wanted to have as clear of a picture as possible of the bigger picture, you know. I even spoke with district attorneys and I had them read the book and all of these things, because I knew even though all of these details wouldn't necessarily make it into the book, it was something I wanted to be informed about. And I honestly, in some ways, I wanted to make myself more aware of these things. I read Trayvon Martin's autopsy report, and I think what struck me about it was, and I get it, this is how an autopsy report is supposed to be, but what struck me was he wasn't treated like a human. When that happens to someone, they're not treated like a human. It's a corpse. It's scientific. And I thought about it. I was like, huh, yes, that's how it's supposed to go in an autopsy report. But in a sense, that's almost what happens in the court cases themselves. These young people are no longer treated as living, breathing human beings. This is a case. This is a subject. This is a carcass now. And that dehumanization of young black people, beyond just an autopsy report, but even in the court system, that's something I wanted to keep in mind in the treatment of Khalil throughout the story. So we see it not just in the court case. We see it when Star's watching the news and he's just called the suspected drug dealer. Or we see it when even her friends at school are like, well, he was just this. He was just that. They make him just something when he was a full human being. So I made myself aware of those things so that I could know the angle that would be given to Khalil if this was to happen.
We're speaking with Angie Thomas about her book, The Hate You Give, which is now going to be a major motion picture. There's something that's interesting. The book is got a lot of subtleties and handles a lot of complex issues. It's not only the racial issues of white police officers and young black men. There's also issues of class. There's issues of code switching for this young woman, Star, because she lives in a historically black neighborhood and goes to a Tony White prep school. Why did you decide to tackle so many things? I mean, that's a lot.
You know, when I was writing it, I wasn't thinking about, oh, I'm tackling these issues. I was trying to write a story of black girlhood that's real to so many black girls. Like, I honestly wasn't. And it's interesting to me now that people are like, oh, you were such a genius in how you did that. And I'm like, oh, thank you. I had no idea. You know?
Well, maybe you're actually explaining to people the complexity of what it means to be a young
black
girl.
Yes, that's exactly what I wanted to do. You know, and I think about that even now as I'm working on my second book. I'm dealing once again with a black girl who often feels as if she's either too much or not enough. And that goes to the way black girls are even criminalized. And that goes into the way we look at poverty. And that goes into just so many different factors of black girlhood. And so when I'm writing these characters, that's what I think about. I want to address the things that they deal with, because these are things that black girls are dealing with. And I hope that my young readers who see themselves in these girls say, yep, that's me. But I hope that other people who aren't these girls see these things and go, wow, we need to fix this. This should not be the case. It should not be the case that Star feels as if she's too much, or she has to box herself in when she goes into certain spaces. What are we telling black girls when we say, if you're too loud, you're too aggressive, we're going to stereotype you? What are we saying to them? So for me, it wasn't so much about the issues as it was about the girls themselves.
Now that you've spent some time in the publishing industry and you know how it works, mm-hmm. why do you think there hadn't been a book written about a police shooting of a young black man before this point? Because we know it's been going on for a long time.
Well, there have been. That's the thing. There were a couple of books that came out before The Hate You Give. One was called How It Went Down by Kekla Magoon, and another was called All American Boys by Jason Reynolds and Brendan Kiley. I think the difference has been in how publishing has decided to treat these stories. You know, those are two amazing books. But I think publishing was honestly in some ways scared, you know, to really put their big machine behind them, like mm-hmm. I've gotten with The Hate You Give. I'm seeing more people find out about those books now, and I'm so glad about it. But I think we've gotten to a point in children's publishing specifically where they're realizing that their readers are woke. You know, kids nowadays are way more aware of things than we give them credit for being, thanks to social media and so many other things. So many of them are concerned about social justice. They're concerned about politics. So we can't water things down and just act like they don't exist. These kids want books that address these things. So I think that's what publishing has seen with The Hate You Give and now other books, is we don't have to just publish these books and not put the big dollars behind them. We can put the big dollars behind them and the kids will still flock to them, even though they address controversial issues.
Your audiences are very mixed. I've seen mm-hmm. about three or four of them. 3 or 4 settings, from Mississippi to New York. Why do you think they're so mixed?
You know, it surprises me every single time. You know, I get the young black boys with the sagging pants who are like, yo, ma, I read this in a day. This is dope. You know, and then I was told recently that someone's 90-year-old grandmother read the book, absolutely adored it, and she carries copies with her in her purse. And when she gets on the bus, if she sees kids with Jordan sneakers, she starts conversations with them about their shoes. And she's like, I have a book I think you should read, you know?
That's such a good story.
That's amazing. But I think it goes to show that we have to recognize that stories, even when they talk to a specific audience, there's something about them that can connect with everyone. You know, I look at Black Panther and the success of Black Panther, and people were like, for years, they were like, black superheroes won't sell. Black superheroes won't sell. Why? If there's a story that people will connect with in some way, it will reach masses, just like we saw. So with The Hate U Give, I think all of us have struggled at some point with whether to speak up and speak out. I think all of us have struggled with the idea of, am I enough? I think all of us have struggled with feeling like we have to be a different person in a different world. So those human elements, although they are very specific to blackness in the book, I think audiences of a wider scale have connected with it because it's something we all deal with in some sense. So I'm still amazed every single day. Like, I have events and the crowds amaze me. I've had events where nothing but old white people, and then I've had events with young black kids.
We're speaking with Angie Thomas about her book, The Hate U Give. On the other side of it, the book has been banned in a town in Texas. Mm-hmm. South Carolina Police Union has spoken out about the book being on a reading list. Where were you when you found out about these things, and what was your initial response, and then now what's your grown-up response?
Okay, both times I found out through the internet. Mm-hmm. I either got a tweet or an email, and both times I was angry. I can't lie. You know, when I heard about the ban in Texas, I was really angry because it was obvious it hadn't been read by any of the administration at the school district. And then the same thing with the police union. You know, my initial reaction specifically with the police union was, I know you haven't read the book because her uncle is a cop. You know, her uncle is a good cop. And so, and I was furious and I was hurt. But I after a while, my grown-up response was, you know what? I must be doing something right. my mom had to remind me. She was like, you're in great company. They ban good books. And I'm like, okay, you're right. People are resistant to change. But I ended up actually coming away from both situations feeling hopeful. The police union in South Carolina banned the book, but it made a police union in another city say, you know what, let's take a look at this. It's in our school's reading list, too. Let's reach out to the school, find out why the kids are reading it. Oh, it's not anti-police. It's anti-police brutality. Why don't we start a book club with the kids so we can work on community relations around the book? They took that and they did something positive with it. I wish the people in South Carolina would have done that. And then in Texas, a 15-year-old girl decided, because she loved the book, she said, no, I'm not letting you take this off of our shelves. She got a petition. She went before the school board and she fought to get the book put back on shelves, and they put it back on shelves because of her. And now she's activated. She's like an activist in her own right now. So I'm okay with it when it happens. Because
that's so meta.
Yeah.
Because the book's
yes.
about becoming an activist.
Yes, yes. I've seen so many young people decide that they're going to speak up, start speaking up and speaking out for this book. And when they do that, they realize, wait, I have a voice. Let me use this for something else, too. So I'm okay with it when it happens. Plus, when you ban books, that just makes people want to read them more. My sales have skyrocketed every single time.
The Hate U Give is about to be a movie. It's being directed by George Tillman. Common is in it. Regina Hall is in it. It's an amazing cast. When did you realize, okay, they're going to get this right? Because a lot of authors have that experience of their book not resembling what you see on the mm-hmm. screen. Was there some moment that you saw and you thought, okay, this is going to be okay?
Well, it was actually before filming. I knew that from the multiple phone calls I got from George Tillman and from the screenwriter. But when I walked onto set, actually when I drove onto set, I it was one of the most surreal moments. I was in my car and I was driving to the location and they were filming Khalil's funeral. And if you read the book, you know that there's a protest after the funeral. And I had my windows down because it was hot in Atlanta. And I hear a chanting. I hear chanting and they're saying, "Justice for Khalil, justice for Khalil." And I had to pull over to the side of the road and I just sobbed because those were words I wrote.
This is the obvious question, and most people ask it at the front of the interview, but I want to ask it at the back now that we've talked about it, the title of the book.
Yes.
What it means, because I think it'll mean more at the end of the interview.
Yes, yes. You know, I have to give a shout out to all the English teachers and grammar nerds, because they love to come at me about the U in the title. I know how to spell the word U, you all. It's if you look at the first letters of the title, it spells out thug, T-H-U-G, the hate you give. That comes from Tupac Shakur. Tupac is my favorite rapper, and he was known for having that thug life tattoo, but a lot of people don't know it was an acronym for the hate you give little infants blanks everybody. And he explained that as meaning what society feeds into youth has a way of affecting us all. And he said this in 1992 in reference to the Los Angeles riots. A lot of people associate that with Rodney King's beating, but it was also in response to the shooting death of a 15-year-old girl named Latasha Harlins. For those who don't know, Latasha was accused of stealing a bottle of juice at a local convenience store in Los Angeles. And video showed Latasha putting her money on the counter and walking away, and the store owner shot her in the back of the head. And the store owner got away with it. And that led to the riots and protests in Los Angeles as well. And Pac said the hate that was given to that little infant, Latasha, affected the entire city of Los Angeles. We're talking millions of dollars in damages. Mm-hmm. As I was writing the book, I looked at Ferguson. I looked at Sanford, Florida. I looked at Cleveland. The hate that was given to those three little infants in Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, and Trayvon Martin affected not only their entire communities, but it affected the world. It blanked everybody. And so that's thug life. If Pac was here, he'd say that's thug life. So it felt like a fitting title for the novel because the hate that's given to Star and to Khalil affects their entire community.
How are you feeling about the future on this issue?
You know, I'm actually a little hopeful. It's going to take some big changes as far as laws and lawmakers, but I have hope. I hope that the book has helped open more eyes to this issue. I've had so many people tell me that it's explained it to them in a way that they now get it. They now get why Colin kneels. You know, I've had older white gentlemen who told me, you know, in Mississippi, he said, "My family was part of the Emmett Till cover-up. We used to laugh about it. Another day I sat in your movie and I cried when I realized what I did and what's still going on, and we got to do something about this." To me, that's huge.
That just gave me—
I know.
We're looking at each other.
I know. Yeah, he cried.
Wow.
He cried. And so I have hope that I think art is going to make people more aware of these things. I think art is going to activate more people and make them want to change things. So I think my biggest hope is that 20 years from now, we won't have to say Black Lives Matter. It'll be understood.
Angie Thomas, thank you so much for joining us on All of It.
Thank you.
Congratulations on all your success. Well earned.
Thank you.
This is All of It on WNYC. More than 6,800 soldiers have died since the beginning of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and the number of soldiers injured passed the 1 million mark back in 2013. Elliot Ackerman, a veteran himself and a novelist, tells the story of one of those million in his latest novel, Waiting for Eden. In the book, a wounded soldier named Eden Malcolm has spent 3 years in a burn center in San Antonio, unable to move or speak. One day he has a stroke, and for the first time in 3 years, he's aware of his conditions and surroundings. It's a gripping story about love and loss and the hard costs of sacrifice. We spoke to Elliot Ackerman back in September, and we are replaying that interview for you now. You decided to go to the Marines. I heard one story, and you blamed it on a book from your childhood. Is that true?
Well, I think it was probably a combination of many things, but maybe the story you're talking about is I was a little bit obsessed when I was a kid with the tales of King Arthur.
Yes.
And I think you'd find amongst people, particularly Marines, there can often be that strain of romanticism that will bring people to service.
One of the things you also mentioned about the Marines is that they're a well-read group. that people bring their different kinds of literature from their lives with them and that you share this. How did that influence your writing at all, the idea of reading all this different kind of literature from all different kinds of people who you guys were collectively together?
I think, you know, ultimately, I mean, Waiting for Eden is, you know, the war kind of lingers off stage in this book, but, you know, it is a book that's ultimately about a marriage. It's about Eden Malcolm and his wife, Mary. And it's also sort of a ghost story because it is all narrated by Eden's dead best friend. Yeah. And you learn about the dynamics between the three of them. But thematically, you know, the book is ultimately, it's sort of about grief and what happens for those of us who have loved ones who, whether they are, in Eden's case, wounded lying in a hospital bed, or in more everyday cases, you know, struggling with whatever issues they might be struggling with that make them inaccessible to us. You know, how do you love someone who cannot move out of that state? And that's ultimately the real question of the book.
Were you thinking about this? Was this a book that you've been thinking about writing for a long time? The subject matter?
You know, this book, each book comes to you a little bit differently. And I will say this one sort of came fully formed in so much as, you know, I don't feel like I wrote this book. I feel like the book sort of wrote me. And it came probably relatively quickly. I wrote it over a period of a few months. And then when I was done with it, it was just sort of down there on the page. So, you'll see if you pick up the book, it's a pretty slim book. It's only about 175 pages. It's... You know, the story is very straightforward.
So you mean the book wrote you? It just poured out of you? You didn't have an outline? You didn't come in saying, I'm going to write a story about a Marine? What does that mean, the book came out of you?
Well, I never have an outline, so maybe that makes me a bad author. I mean that it just came very clearly. Like, the story announced itself very clearly. That doesn't mean it's better or worse than another story. You know, some stories you really have to wrestle with, and you get to the end, and it can, you know, be some of the work you're most proud of. But some books really just come very clearly, and this is one that came through very clearly to me.
Let's talk about the character, Eden. I mean, he's not, I don't want to call him the central character because there's so many different stories. Everyone almost feels like the central character. So Eden's Humvee was hit by an IED in the Hummer and Valerie in central Iraq. It leaves him in this catatonic state. Can you tell us a little bit about Eden before the accident, who he was before? We kind of get that a little bit later in the book.
Right. Well, you know, the book opens up and tells you a little bit about him. And he was a guy who was larger than life, weighed 220 pounds. His friends called him Base Jump because one day during a hurricane, he jumped off the third story of a building with a poncho over his head and managed to land on the ground when the wind carried him. But he's also someone who kind of defies categorization. He loves to cook. He can tell you everything about different wines that he likes to collect. So he was just someone who was living a very wide, varied, and full life before this accident puts him in a hospital bed, and his world basically becomes extremely narrow, and his universe is the bed and this room that he's in.
We're speaking with Elliot Ackerman. His new book is called Waiting for Eden. Eden does not tell his story, however. His friend, who is already dead, lets us know what's going on and lets us understand who Eden was and what's happened to him. Why was it that choice?
Well, it was interesting in so much as I knew this book needed to be a really intimate book. And usually when you're writing, if you want to bring the reader in and give them that level of intimacy, oftentimes you'll write with a first-person narrator. But I also knew that I needed to be able to go back in time, forwards in time, and have access to everybody's thoughts in this story. So that would usually lend you towards a omniscient third-person narrator. So how I bridged that was it came to me that the narrator is dead. So he's narrating in the first person, but he knows everything because he's dead.
We mentioned in the intro that Eden has a stroke and he's aware. He's not awake, he's aware. And can I ask you to read a passage? This passage here on page 82, start with a rush.
Certainly. A rush of anxiety welled up in him, crashed, and then spilled like a silent wave of nothing. For there was nothing he wanted to see or hear. If he could have heard, the nurses would have told him he was blind. If he could have seen, the nurses would have written words to tell him he was deaf. I won't be afraid, he promised himself. I will be bigger than everyone else. I will be dead. I will be on this earth closer to death than anyone and knowing that what only the dead know. That is something, he thought, to know what only the dead know. And what is that? All they know is they were once alive and are dead only because of it.
Something I wondered as I was reading the book was, does Eden want to die, or does he just want to communicate about dying?
That's an interesting question. Also, I think, you know, one of the central questions of the book is this choice.
Right.
And when Eden, you know, and obviously the choice is whether or not that Eden should be let go and his wife should euthanize him, or whether mm-hmm. he should carry on. And Eden waking up gives him agency in that choice. And so the tension between, I don't want to spoil it, between what his wife chooses and what he chooses for himself, you can only understand the tension of that final choice if you understand it in the context of their marriage. Mm-hmm. And I think underpinning, you know, whether or not Eden wants to die or whether or not his wife wants to let him go is this idea of grief. You know, I think when we think of grief, we think of it as a transitory state, which is something happens, some tragedy occurs, you grieve, you move through your period of grieving, and on the other end, there's a healing that occurs and you can move on. You know, but what happens with Eden is you're stuck in this transitory state and you can't move through it. And this idea of what happens when grief doesn't fulfill its promise of healing on the other end, and then you're just sort of stuck waiting, and how do you move through that? And I think as a veteran, I've seen this with people mm-hmm. I know who've struggled to come home from the wars, but I've seen it with people I know who struggled with trauma and disappointments in their own lives and their limitations. I think it's something that's universal with us, which is how do we reconcile and make whole people who have lost something profound in their lives? And that's, you know, that's really, in my mind, what this book and this choice that Mary and Eden have to make is about.
Mary, his wife, is also waiting.
Yes, very much so.
What is she waiting for? Is she waiting for a sign from him? Is she waiting for a sign from God? Is she waiting to be relieved of her grief before she can make a choice?
I think she, when the book opens, she doesn't know what she's waiting for. She just knows that her instincts have her at his bedside and that she is loyal to him. And when you read the book and what the narrator tells you about their relationship is you start to understand why, despite the imperfections in their marriage, and every marriage has mm-hmm. them, she has ended up in this place where she will wait for him for as long as it takes. And so ultimately, you know, the way she waits is sort of like it's just a type of vigil. She might not be waiting for anything. So, you know, if you read the book, I think it's left open enough that you can still ask that question.
There's also this idea of what you should do. There's a lot of shoulds. There's a question of whether Mary should bring their child to see the father in the state.
Right.
Should she leave to go for Christmas? Can you talk a little bit or a little bit about how shoulds play into the story a little bit more?
Eden is in an impossible situation. And I wanted to show how in this situation, there are a million little decisions that we might not see at face value, but you can imagine that you come up against. Like, for instance, when Eden is wounded, Mary's pregnant. And so she is by his bedside pregnant. She will not leave. So she winds up having their daughter in the same hospital that he is interred in. So that becomes a whole decision of how does he meet his daughter for the first time? Mm-hmm. And then, so with all these shoulds, what you're basically doing is overlaying a moral calculus onto the situation. And I think what the reader will find, what I found when I was writing it, was what the morally correct thing to do would be in those situations is not clear.
Not at all.
At all.
And that's part of sort of that's one of the interesting things in reading the book.
Right.
As you think to yourself, what would I do?
Yes, and I think that's, you know, that's one of the joys of fiction. The writing that I like to read leaves a most generous space between the reader and the author so that in that space the reader can ask those questions and not have the author answer them for him or her.
You describe some of his burns and some of the medical procedures in some really some detail that it makes me uncomfortable a little bit to read it. Were these things you witnessed firsthand?
There, I mean, I've seen my fair share of gruesome things in the war, but not like this specifically. I didn't want to shy away from Eden's condition. I wanted it to feel very tactile to the reader, mm-hmm. as though they could understand it. And when I'm describing Eden, I describe his body is also sort of becoming part of Mary's body, because Mary is watching him, and over years, where every single decision about Eden's body becomes her decision about his body. There's a segment in the book where I talk about how he starts to transmute himself onto her, and in order to do that effectively, I felt like I really needed to say what things felt like. Mm-hmm. So that's why those descriptions are so vivid.
What is it you wanted to explore about trauma in this book?
Well, I think I really wanted to explore love and fidelity, which is often a form of trauma.
Which does be traumatic, yes.
Which is usually traumatic. I mean, the things that you love wind up breaking you. Most of the time, I could think of a few things that you love that don't wind up breaking you is because you invest yourselves in them. So I wanted to tell a story about, you know, two people who loved each other in a very broken way, and to see the extent of that love and how far it could potentially take them. So, you know, this is a love story. It's, you know, it's not a love story in the, you know, conventional, you know, roses and romance sense, but it's about fidelity, which I think is at the core of love once you get past the sort of romantic stuff.
What about loyalty?
And loyalty too, which is at the core of love. How people keep faith with one another and how they find meaning in their lives through keeping that faith. So I really wanted to try to reduce these characters down to their essence, and the narrator as well, how he keeps loyalty to his friend. Because the narrator is actually, he is dead, but he is entrapped in a sort of purgatory. And so a question for him also becomes, how does he get out of this purgatory, and why is he there in the first place? Why is he witnessing all of these things?
And waiting.
And waiting with everybody else. And so he appears, and he, like Mary, they have this bond in that they are both, the narrator and Mary, waiting.
I couldn't tell from reading the book, but does the book have a stance about war and about this specific war, do you think?
Not really, except that I just try to tell the story as, you know, with as much truth as possible. I don't think anyone. First of all, the war happens off stage. I think there's probably a page or two that reflect the war, and the war is what kind of gets Eden into the bed. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to tell a story, and what I hope the book does, because it was sort of my ambition, is a story that is accessible to anybody, whether you care about these wars, whether you don't, whether you're watching the news and reading all the updates from Afghanistan, or whether that's not even on your radar. Mm-hmm. And my hope is that, you know, for the person who feels deeply invested in the wars, that they'll read this book and they'll feel that it feeds that interest. And for the person who is not, that they will read this book and maybe feel a little bit tapped into something, a subject matter they hadn't felt tapped in before.
Your work as well as a journalist, and as someone who's experienced these wars, and you've written this really interesting book about the aftermath, what it does to people's lives, what do you think was a story or a subject matter that journalists missed about these two wars? The story that hasn't really been told fully or properly.
I don't know if this is a specific journalistic story, but I'll kind of relay to you an anecdote that I always felt coming home. I'm getting a little bit older, but when I first came home, you know, people would consistently say to me, and well-intentioned people, you know, wow, I can't imagine what it must have been like over there, what you went through. And these people were well-intentioned, but I don't know if they understood how kind of disempowering that makes you feel. Because if you can't imagine what I went through over there, it means that in some way, the person I was when I left, who was someone that was accessible to you, I went over to these wars, I fought there, and now something has happened to me to make a part of me unimaginable to you. And so I would always say to people, yeah, sure, you can imagine. You can imagine it. Have you ever been in a car, seen a car accident, been in a car accident, had to do something that scared you, lost someone you loved? Of course you can imagine. This is actually a pretty common human experience, because if you can't imagine it, it means there's a part of me that's forever walled off from you and is now inaccessible. And so it means that the whole of me never gets to come home. So so that might not necessarily be a journalistic story per se, but I think it's something that gets that's overlooked. I mean, I really do feel I'm the same guy I was when I left. You know, I've had some experiences, but haven't we all? I mean, who's the exact same person they were 10 years ago? But for whatever reason, people don't talk enough about how, you know, people can come back from wars and not be forever and traumatically changed in ways that make them inaccessible.
Now, I know from the book writing process, this book has been done for a while. You're out doing publicity now. Huh. When are you getting back to writing?
Oh, I write every day.
You do so, write every day?
Yeah, so I'm...
Where do you find time? How do you do it?
I wake up early.
And you do write every day?
Yeah, I do. Or, I work every day, write or revise or whatever. Whatever project I've got kicking around, I'm putting hours on every day.
Okay, so we'll get a new book soon?
Yes, I have a book out of journalism that's coming out in the spring.
Oh, excellent. Will you come back then?
I would love to.
Okay, Elliot Ackerman, the name of the book is Waiting for Eden. Thank you so much for joining us on All of It.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Allison.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.